Welcome to Polycast, a Civilization podcast focused on game strategy. Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mian Team.
Ed Jin.
With guest co-host
Morton Alvito.
Let's not pronounce your mom.
Yeah. Are you trolling the chat, Maggie?
No, I'm
it's my
not.
Job. I don't know what's happening here.
Bill's losing his troll job.
Bill, your services are no longer.
Man, I take one new job and I look over my shoulder and my trolling job is just people are all over it. It's craziness.
Hello and welcome to episode 154. I'm Dan Q. The answer, simple, elegant, stately. The question, what are three antonyms to describe Polycast? I'm also joined by a regular co-host, Makalua.
And if you think having the Super Mario theme stuck in your head is bad, wait till you get the Zelda theme stuck in your head.
The Mian Team.
Double kill. Triple kill. Gods and
Kings-like.
Nope. Gods and Kings-like.
Imagine.
Mom! I want my mom.
And our returning guest, Martin Alvito.
Hello from the Diablo 3 Real Money Auction House.
So wait, you're talking about Mom. Does that mean that Firaxis is going to remake Master of Magic after they remake XCOM?
Hell no.
So this is one of those classic optimization problems that you face in Civ. The question that's being asked is which tile to build a great person improvement on. And the question that Anandis is asking is, when I settle a great person, I'm always in a bit of a dilemma where to settle him, whether to settle him on a rich tile that supplies food and hammers and gold in and of itself, or to settle it on a poor tile that makes that tile worthwhile. And the reason that this question is interesting, and it's been asked many times since the game released originally, when you're sitting there and you're trying to figure out how to get as much of whatever you want as you can, the big thing that you want to do is figure out how to extract as much as you possibly can from the land which you are given by the map. The answer to this question is a little non-obvious, which is why it keeps getting asked over time and time again. I think Vexing and Dave McW in particular do a very good job of addressing the question in the thread, in that what you want to do is you want to put yourself in a position where you always want to put the great person improvement on a tile you're going to be working anyway. The reason for this is that if you're placing the great person improvement on a tile you would not otherwise be working, you're giving something up. And so it's very important that whichever tile you drop it on is within the set of tiles that you would be working with the population that you've got. And then the other thing that you want to think about when you're addressing this problem is you want to put yourself in a position where you're giving up as little as you as possible from placing the great person improvement on that tile. So you have to look at what you would otherwise be producing on that tile if you put a regular improvement on it rather than the great person improvement. Or basically, the good tiles to look for in that more or less meet those criteria are sheep, wheat that's not on a river, and horses that are in horse tiles. The reason that those work well is because you're giving up typically a small amount of food that you would be getting if you improve the tile normally. And in return, you're placing this on a tile that otherwise you'd like to be working because it naturally has its own inherent improvements.
To get into it, I mean, with sheep, when you improve it, you go to two food rather than one food, and it's on a hill already, so you've already got two hammers coming out of that sheep tile. And as long as you have another pasturable tile around, you can always build the stable if you have it pastured. So if you build the stable, you're still going to get plus one hammer on that sheep because the stable building, just like the granary, goes towards the resource itself, not the improvement. So you can always get the bonuses from that, which is why those are pretty much the best tiles. Slapping it down on a straight desert tile is almost always the worst thing you could possibly do. One of the other things you have to balance out is the amount of food that you're running. You may be able to drop down a lot of great people improvement tiles, but if to work those tiles, you have to turn around and work, another twice as many food tiles, then you're going to end up causing yourself less useful balance in your city than if you can find a way to sneak some food in there with the actual great people tiles.
And the same with earlier Civ games as well. It's one of those things where if you just run the math on it, you'll see it. And it might not be intuitive at first, but it was the same deal on Civ 4. You have floodplains and you have some grassland. You want to cottage stuff. Unless you have massive, massive, massive amounts of worker turns and you farm everything at first and then grow and then switch it all instantly to cottages later. And once you're already at the optimized city population, you're always better off just cottaging the floodplains rather than farming floodplains and cottaging other tiles. And it's the same thing with high yield on great people improvements in Civ 5. You really want to be on a good tile from the start there.
Yeah, I think one of the popular solutions that's usually a mistake is to put it, or the improvement on a two-food grassland tile, thinking being that you're giving up very little in order to do it. But the problem with doing that is that that's a tile you don't really want to be working in the first place, because you basically, in order to work that tile, you have to grow another growth step in order to put somebody onto it, and that takes time. And additionally, you're not getting anything out of that particular tile anyway. You're just getting two more food that sustains the citizens. So in most cases, it's, you know, you'd rather be running a specialist or something along those lines rather than put somebody on that tile.
Well, I guess it depends on where else you can do. I mean, if you run out of sheep, but you're still dropping great people, well, then secondary choice would definitely be a grassland tile versus, say, a hill. Because if you drop it on the hill, now you need to not only grow to be able to work the tile, but you have to work a four food tile just to make the next two citizens be able to handle that great person tile.
Types of improvements that we are talking about from your great people: the landmark from the artist, the manufactory from the engineer, citadel from the general. We talked about that in a little more detail last week, although less so perhaps than the other ones here. Custom house from a merchant, the holy site from a prophet, and a academy from a scientist.
One of the few little nagging points in here is the cow. It's still pasturable one, but it's three food. The two improvements that it gets from the stable and that, you end up losing one food, one hammer in the long run for not dropping it there. But people tend to forget about the cow. And actually, I'd probably want to put the manufactory on the cow versus on a hill. Especially in Gods and Kings, there are three improvements for it. So with Gods and Kings mined, hill is plus three over that. So that's already up to five. So if you're dropping a manufactory, now you have three versus another five for the manufactory. So you're actually only going up plus two. Whereas if you, say, drop the manufactory on the cow, well, you're actually making more food and you're only losing two. So you're actually at plus three.
Yeah, I totally forgot about the cow. I've put a lot of Babylon Academies on cows over my time playing this game.
There's a growth function here. You know, do you want to continue growing that city or not? But you're not really losing out much on putting it on the cow then, I suppose, as opposed to another tile.
Well, you lose the food for fertilizer, which is way deep into into the tech tree. So it's well worth ignoring.
Well, the thing about it is that a lot of times you want to share a cow, like you're doing an ICSC sort of plan, you want to share that cow tile around across different cities until you have something like the National College up, because what you do is you use that tile to grow all, you know, your initial cities next to the capital.
Yeah, well, it's pretty much all tiles. The only one that you should never put a great person tile on, and I think it was said in this thread somewhere along the way, is don't put it on a luxury, because you won't improve the luxury with the great person tile.
No.
And we want a shiny happiness.
If you do have a Petra-based desert city, then it is worth dropping them on the deserts, because you'll end up with the one food, one hammer, one gold from all the desert tiles, and one faith if you went desert faith. So it is worth dropping great people tiles all over that, as long as you have the floodplains to keep it going. D. Thompson 32 on CFC asked, are helicopters kind of meh, or is he missing something? Basically, with the switch from Civ 5 Vanilla to now Gods and Kings, he finds that he's generally ignoring building the helicopters. You know, when he first got the game, he's so excited to use them because they sounded really cool. And then he found out that artillery and bombers and fighters just wreck them. So, given that they're very fragile, little defenses, and their big bonus is attacking tanks and armor, does anybody actually use these things? And if so, what's the strategy that he's missing to make them effective? With Gods and Kings, the spearman upgrades to the pike, upgrades to the lancer, upgrades to the anti-tank gun, and finally you get your helicopter. Building helicopters straight, nice and clean, building them outright rather than upgrading into them, they do tend to be a little more painful to use, because you have to go through two mobility promotions or two anti-armor promotions before you get to logistics, and logistics is the thing that makes helicopters useful, because at that point they can attack and move, kind of like their horse-based predecessor of the Lancer. So I guess on the strategy side of things, they are 60 combat strength unit in the late game. Infantry are 70, give or take. Bombers and triplanes are about 50. So yeah, they're in the mix there. They're probably a little weak on the pure combat strength side of things, but they do get a plus 100% versus armor units. So, and that's before the other promotions. So they're about 120 versus modern armor, and modern armor being at 100. If your opponent has a bunch of tanks, helicopters are great because you can move attack and then get out of there, especially if you have a bunch of mountains floating around, because then they can't attack back with normal units, except for the air units, of course. Otherwise, I think helicopters, even in Gods and Kings, it's best just to upgrade into them. Because if you have the Lancer, the move after attacking, as far as I remember, it's still around.
Yes.
It sticks around on upgrade. So you can have that move and it move after attack on helicopters right away, which of course is a little silly. But also given that they upgrade from pikes and spears, and with the Lancers, you can get yourself to march on those units fairly easily and even add in some charge while you're a Lancer and a few other things. At which point, if you've kept your spears and pikes and Lancers around and been able to promote them, then you can have some very, very powerful helicopters flying around, especially Persian immortal helicopters with march.
Towards Imagine is also saying very good for scouting because they ignore terrain costs. And in addition to mountain tiles, they can hover over ice tiles.
Along the lines of general griefing, Snarsbury in the thread points out that if you take the Ottoman unique Lancer unit and you upgrade that to a helicopter, you can pretty much run around and pillage like a complete maniac.
Yeah. It's like 8-move helicopter pillaging for free. The thing that people tend to get into the problem with is there's a lot of people who are still bomber focused as a primary attack unit, and therefore you might have a couple fighters to go along with that. And so if you do bomber-centric strategy, then yeah, helicopters are kind of less useful because, well, bombers are going to take care of pretty much everything. Fighters for interceptions and air sweeps. And then helicopters can't take cities, so you're still going to need something other than a helicopter to go mop up cities. But if you don't have a bomber-centric approach, which is kind of rare to see, but can be just as viable, then helicopters are very, very useful. Rocket artillery and stuff like that is typically in behind the front line. And if with helicopters moving upwards of 8 tiles at a time, that's very easy to flank around and take them down, provided you have air cover.
And note also that the gunship we talked about, you know, moving as a land unit, no defensive terrain bonuses, and also requires aluminum.
Yes.
The upgrade path, important, but just, I wouldn't be upgrading all of your, I can upgrade all of these Lancers that I have, or finally upgrade some of these pikemen up to helicopter gunships. I wouldn't be doing that for every single one. That aluminum is precious.
True, but now you can get 10 of your own just by building a couple recycling centers. So you can balance that out. But no, they are not like the core. No one should ever use them as the core of an army, especially since you have to stop at anti-tank guns along the way. You're right. There are better uses of aluminum sometimes, like spaceship parts.
Stealth bombers.
Yeah, good luck. I'll have about 50 helicopters by the time you get to stealth bombers.
Yeah, but
not if it's vanilla.
Yeah, it's not vanilla no more. We don't play that game.
Ball.
I'd still rather hold on to my aluminum for the stealth bombers and forget about having so many helicopters. Maybe go on to the next topic.
Which is more aluminum. Hey.
Ooh, there's a segue inherently built right in. Hey, all right.
Yeah, Amorphous over on Sifanatics wanted to know if, suppose he had aluminum from a city stay, which allowed him to build a hydroplant. If he no longer has an aluminum, does the hydroplant still do its job or not?
Yes.
Here we go. Well, I was sitting here thinking, you know, in real life, pipes don't stop working because you can't make more of them.
It works basically just like the factory when you run out of coal. It still works. It probably shouldn't.
With the factory and the coal, no, that should not work. With the hydroplant and the aluminum, I could see it still working if you wanted to be realistic, quote-unquote, about it.
add to it. If you lose your aluminum, the issue is more about your units that may be using that aluminum because of the 50% combat penalty.
Yes, your aluminum hydro plant does not use that much aluminum.
And as DSLR2 points out, keep in mind if you want to build units that require those resources, the first resources that are available will go to maintaining those buildings.
If you're already using three aluminum with the hydro plants and you get four new stuff and you've been negative three, it'll go to the hydro plants and then you'll only have one for the units. So you're still going to be negative in your strategic resource usage, but it's not going to hurt you otherwise if you never get more aluminum, except for the whole unit thing. Artifacts 1 over on CFC asked in the new Gods and Kings section, now that everybody's been playing it for a while, do you think social policies are evenly balanced now? So are there still some weaker or more powerful in general, or is it balanced? What people tend to focus on the more evenly balanced are, with Gods and Kings, a number of the social policies got shifted around. And by shifted around, I mean little mechanics changes happened, even though the social policies are still the same in most cases. So like with Liberty, the finisher is still a free great person, but the mechanic now exists that when you take it, it costs you a great person. So your great person points requirement for your next great person goes up by 100, just like if you produced it naturally. So that was a point of balance. The Free Settler got moved to where Republic used to be. So Republic and the Free Settler got switched. So you don't get your Free Settler as quickly as you would in vanilla. And then Tradition, of course, now you have four free aqueducts on the finisher. Legalism actually works for once.
Yes, and Legalism giving you a free culture building in your first four cities, otherwise known as a monument, or if you have the unique building for that, then whatever that's called.
Yeah, or if you wait and take it later, you no longer have to get to the tech before you take Legalism. You just have to have the buildings in your first four cities that are the prerequisites for the building that you want. A lot of unique buildings, slightly skewed because they're temple replacements now rather than amphitheater replacements. Otherwise, I mean, that's the primary point where people look to question balance. Is Tradition or Liberty more balanced now that Liberty is slightly more expensive to take? Tradition and Liberty are a lot more balanced, and that seems to be what Riffler is saying in this thread. When it comes to the other social policy trees, though, that's where most of this discussion gets broken. Rationalism might need a nerf, as a comment. Rationalism got a massive nerf hammer to it in Gods and Kings already. And the massive nerf hammer is the fact that while the policies in rationalism did not change, they got rearranged. So the two free techs are now on the finisher. So you actually have to finish the tree to get the most powerful social policy in the late game, at least out of rationalism anyways. The research agreement boost got moved to scientific revolution. So you need three social policies, not one, to get your research agreements going on. Happiness got nerfed in a massive way on social policies, especially in Piety, where you're no longer getting happiness from temples and other former culture buildings. I think in the grand scheme of things, Piety might be weaker, though I think people are still discounting Piety's power on founding
a religion.
Yeah, and then keep it.
A lot of the discussion breaks down into, like you're saying, Tradition and Liberty, and in there, some people also question whether you should be going Honor instead, and then it became more of a discussion of, as kind of a secondary tree, after you decide between Tradition and Liberty, do you go Honor, and how far do you go down Honor? When it comes to Piety and Rationalism, I would agree that I think that you were getting at that Piety is being discounted as far as founding a religion goes, although I do much prefer rationalism, even though it comes a little later. And as far as, well, how else are you going to be able to found a religion, Dan? Well, between, you know, religious city-state alliances or just finding them, working particular natural wonders and getting, you know, your shrines up and then going to philosophy to get your temples, I'd much rather wait almost all of the time for rationalism. And of course, the reason we have this discussion between Piety versus rationalism is that you cannot be working both of them at the same time. Then the other discussion that really haven't touched on just yet is the freedom versus autocracy versus order, which I think is, out of all of the social policies, the most interesting discussion and the one that opens itself up for the most arguments in terms of favoring one over the other. Order, increased happiness, one per city. Yes, being able to purchase great engineers with faith. With the faith, there's a lot of ability now to be able to purchase great people with faith. And my favorite, just to go back to rationalism, is to be able to purchase great scientists with faith, which is another reason I love rationalism over piety. Adopting all policies in the order tree will grant +2 food production, science, gold, and culture per city. It used to be one, but for me, the opener of increasing happiness by one per city, you know, we talk about before order being, as described in the game, best for large, sprawling empires. I'm not saying it is the best, but it is a best. Talking about, you know, production and science, it seems to go well with me with rationalism, because you can get down to planned economy where factories increase city science output by 25%. And we now have the addition in Gods and Kings of building factories half the time. Socialism, gold maintenance cost of buildings reduced by 15%. It used to be 10. So I really do like order, and it's actually one of the social policies, in addition to liberty, that I like to go for the finisher because of the strength. But I don't want to knock either autocracy or freedom.
I think on order you missed probably the most important change in there. Communism, +1 hammers to all mines and quarries.
Oh, yes, yes. It used to be +10% production when constructing buildings.
Yes.
And that comes after socialism.
Yeah.
And socialism comes after planned economy.
Yep.
What were we talking about? Oh, yes. Autocracy reduces unit gold maintenance by 33%. But now you also receive 10 culture as plunder for each point of culture produced in the captured city. That's new. And then they also changed the finisher, which I thought was a very good idea, because I kind of often went meh with it. Not so much about a 25% attack bonus as opposed to a 20, but now it applies to all military units for 50 turns as opposed to 30. Militarism is still the same, about gold cost purchasing units reduced by 33%. Police state used to be -50% unhappiness in annexed cities. I think this is the best boost to autocracy. +3 local happiness from every courthouse. Build courthouses in half the time. And yes, there's also a spy benefit there. I'll say it just for completeness sake, even though I don't think it's particularly awesome. Effectiveness of enemy spies reduced by 25%, and your counter spies have a 25% increased chance of catching enemy spies. I'd just rather have counter espionage and statutories and police stations if necessary instead.
Yeah, but the Great Firewall is the only way to really shut down all spying on you. So going autocracy for police state is not a bad thing if you're running a mass war-based empire. Because if you got to think about that plan, if you went into autocracy, you're probably sticking on the military tax. And if you're on the military tax, you really don't want people stealing them from you. Because they would just turn around and build units. And defend themselves. You can't discount that one. And with police state, actually, just like with other things, the big change to police state is the fact that courthouses no longer remove all of that unhappiness. So a courthouse is no longer a free, you know, +3 happiness or +6 with the police state bonus. That the unhappiness for the base city is now finally back in. So you can't use courthouses to knock out all your happiness.
Other changes to autocracy at fascism, all great generals receive +2 movement. That was an addition. And then a change in total war with production when building military units is now +25% instead of +15. I believe it's with autocracy you can purchase great generals and great admirals with faith as well. Not that I've ever done that.
Yeah, that seems the least useful.
It's like, I think I'd be generating great generals and great admirals just through, I don't know, combat.
Yeah, except that you can't burn them for golden ages anymore. So,
oh, I can't constantly fuel my golden age by getting more great generals?
Yeah, I can convert my faith into citadels. Woohoo! Except that citadels now have the culture bomb approach. So you can actually use that to march an army all the way through somebody's territory if you really want to.
Yes, you can. And actually, I like that change, because that, doing the culture bomb plus the citadel having that combined, I actually enjoy that more than just the straight culture bomb that it was before, because the culture bomb has never been as we see in Civilization IV. Or can see in Civilization IV. Oh, wow. Oh. Yeah. Anyway, flashbacks. freedom, unlocks an industrial now. So truly, I think it becomes a bit more of a, do I go to that? Do I go to autocracy? Do I go to order? It used to come at a renaissance. You can purchase great artists with faith now, with freedom. And I think...
Yeah, none of the actual policies changed.
No.
It was just a shift to later. And you go, yeah, dude, play culture. Play a culture game, get into freedom. Mass convert faith to great artists, because great artists are the only things that can produce golden ages now. And golden ages produce culture now. So.
Well, yes, let me make it clear, I don't play culture games, so that's...
Yeah, I was going to say, Dan's a warmonger these days.
Yeah.
I'm afraid so.
Dan's always been a warmonger.
As long as you
At least
know
as long as I've been playing with him. Yeah, a couple years at least.
No, he didn't used to be.
And just to go back to piety briefly, only because you said in the start, imagine that there wasn't any changes in terms of, you know, like the names of things, for example, or a complete substitution, but... Of course, in piety, there no longer is the social policy known as free religion.
Yeah, that's true.
For some reason, I wonder why they did that.
Religion now costs you.
Yeah. No more free religion for you. It's now religious tolerance, which reduces the culture cost of future policies by 10%.
Which used to be the former finisher.
Yes, and now instead the finisher is...
Costs for... faith-based units and buildings are reduced by 30%, and then holy sites give you +3 gold and +3 culture.
The one that is not changed in any way, and I'm fine with that, because it was fine the way it was, and that was patronage.
Yeah, except it wasn't changed, but mechanics were changed.
Yes.
And the big mechanics change in there, obviously, is that now asceticism and pledge to protect and papal primacy all adjust your floating your resting point up by 20. And it's up by 20, not 220, which is a very useful point to note. Pledge to protect is up by another 10. And, of course, papal primacy is up by 15. So that part got changed, so you can have Insta-friends all game long if you go with Papal Primacy or Pledge to Protect and Ascetics. So you can horribly abuse the city-states just by having two of those things. Gold costs for like how much money you're spending to get influence from city-states has been nerfed a bit. Quests got added. So while the patronage policies haven't actually changed in their text format... pretty much everything about city-states has changed. Plus, you can bully city-states and eventually lose your resting point down by another 20 and all that other fun stuff. On the whole, patronage seems to have been left alone. But it's all these little mechanics changes that are all behind the scenes that a lot of people don't even notice. That's the stuff that is really forcing a lot of balance changes. Of course, the big winner, I think, out of all of the social policies is, of course, commerce.
Yes. Yes, it needed it.
Yeah. Like, everybody's like, no, commerce is stupid unless you're on a water map. And even then, you only want the left side. But commerce now, with the finisher giving +1 gold per trading post, makes that TP spam even better. And especially with the finisher now doubling the gold output of great merchants, the trade missions, so that in the information age, you can get 2,000 gold per trade mission. That's not too shabby.
Especially considering what gold can buy.
Everything.
And of course, yes, great merchants can be purchased with faith to continue with that.
Oh, and I think the cheaper purchase one. Mercantilism?
Yeah, purchasing items in cities requiring 25% less gold.
Yeah, that also got the +1 science per commerce building. And, well, protectionism finally is in line with the other social policies. Protectionism now provides +2 happiness per luxury item that you get rather than +1. Oh, and then there's that free great admiral at the water tech.
Yes, that naval tradition.
Yeah.
In looking at all of these social policies overall, back to the initial question, because there was an initial question, artifacts about, you know, do you think that the social policies are evenly balanced now? In a way, yes, and in a way, no. I think that they're more balanced, but if you said that they were evenly balanced, someone could interpret that as, well, then how do you decide which one to go for? And as we already talked about, you know, like, for example, freedom, not interested in a culture game myself, I just kind of go, that's nice, and look somewhere else. Whereas, of course, if you're playing a culture game, it's like, ooh, shinies, goodies. There are those that are, I would say, more specific, geared towards specific strategies, but then other ones that can help you, not so much regardless of what you're doing necessarily to that extreme, but are more versatile, like commerce, for example, patronage, although, of course, if you're not playing with city-states. And I would say, generally speaking, and I already kind of touched on this, I said, yes, rationalism for myself over piety. I would take order over autocracy, but autocracy over freedom. And when it comes to the tradition versus liberty, I know there's the versus honor in there, but I'm kind of, now let's just talk about tradition versus liberty. That is the hardest one to say, but I think on balance, I would choose liberty over tradition, but that's not exclusively. There are very few social policies, I would say, other than freedom and even piety would be the two social policies that I would be very unlikely to choose any. And, of course, freedom more so because they come at the expense of order or autocracy. But I think that the even balance means that I have more of a mix. And because of how more balanced they are, I have to think a little more about which ones do I actually want to go to the effort of finishing. Because depending upon the stage of your game, what it is that you want to do, and sometimes also what it is that you can to do, you may have to change your mind. And so overall, I like it.
Well, I'd say it's better. Tradition, liberty, balance is a lot better. I am seeing a lot more people want to go with tradition and coming out with the tradition starts, mostly for the four free aqueducts because, hey, four free aqueducts, and you don't even need engineering for it. You just get the four free buildings. So you can completely ignore that side of the tech tree and still get them. So I think that's better. Honor, people just don't get the concept, I think. There has been other threads, which we may get to in other shows, we're talking about honor, but it's the three styles of empires. Either you build your capital up nice and powerful with a couple satellite cities with tradition, but you do that peacefully. You go liberty and just try and spam cities all over the place, or at least take up more than the three or four, but it's still, you're doing that peacefully. Or you go honor because you have Monty, you know, 2 feet from you, and his cities look better than yours. So you go for the, I'm going to do an early game fight sort of plan. Honor does work, as much as people are usually saying that it doesn't, but they're not aggressive enough. An honor start can work if you are going to steal somebody's empire. If you convert all the effort and everything spent on building the military and going honor into taking cities, then you absolutely have a perfectly fine start. If you take honor and then just sit there and farm barbs, probably not as useful as a primary.
So I would agree with that.
Oligarchy plus honor, always useful. Actually, honor now more so than ever because of the free happiness with walls and castles and such, which you absolutely will be building a lot more walls and sometimes castles in Gods and Kings than you would in vanilla. Otherwise, you're just going to lose everything.
Yes. And then with that professional army, you start combining it with a certain wonder that we've talked about before, and even more happiness.
Yay, Neuschwanstein.
Yes, the one at Railroad. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, the one balance problem that I think is still a little bit intractable here for them is the fact that the industrial era social policies are, at least in my mind, pretty much always going to be underpowered simply because if you're playing ideally, you're simply not going to have enough time to get through the tree, no matter how hard you try, unless you're playing a culture game and ripping through freedom. The issue is basically that you only have so much time to get policies once you get to the industrial age. And I think of the AI as like a clock. You know, it basically is at some semi-random interval going to get nukes and nuke the snot out of you and beat you if you don't get out of the game before it gets to that point. The one thing that still concerns me a little bit about balance is that I think that order and autocracy in particular could still use a little bit more oomph than they've got, having been souped up.
I guess one thing you have to keep in mind is that the industrial era is not exactly the watershed moment that it used to be. With the addition of the atomic age, and the fact that riflemen and industrialization and a few techs like that are now in the industrial era, a lot of stuff got pushed back. But even still, I mean, if you go based on a number of turns sort of plan, You should hit industrial about turn 150, 160, maybe 170, depending on how fast you plow into it. And you're going to add another 100 turns almost to your game on that. Unless, of course, you're doing super speedy things. But I'm sure some of those research agreement issues will get patched out pretty quickly. Because research agreements and great scientist bulbs all got changed for Gods and Kings. So you're not going to fly through the tech tree as fast as possible as before. Some adjustment in there. But that's probably why Autocracy got the boost for culture in its opener. So that if you are using Autocracy to go military fighting, then you're going to get culture from all those cities that you're taking. So that'll help plow you through the social policy tree. Order doesn't have it, but then again, order doesn't need it. Plus, happiness at the start is pretty much one of the most powerful policies of those trees, of the three. So especially if you have wide empire.
It's the opener that really often tips the scale.
And you know what? If you went piety for your religion instead of waiting for rationalism, all that extra happiness gets converted to culture. Just saying.
I'd still rather have the science advantage, to be honest. But that's the nice thing about a lot of these changes to the social policies is, you know, there's more than one right answer.
Yeah, unfortunately, theocracy is never the right answer. Plus 10% gold from temples just doesn't seem to be that useful. And I would suggest that that's probably the weak point is theocracy. It'd be nice if, now that piety is now half religion, theocracy, organized religion, the opener, and even the finisher, it's all religion-based. It'd be nice if theocracy gave you some sort of bonus to religious spread within your empire, or at least something along that line.
Yes, there was someone in the thread that said piety seems to have this identity crisis between culture and faith. I think that's well put.
Most everything else in piety seems perfectly fine. Now, of course, do you need a religion to play in Gods and Kings and still do fine? No. But if you want to find a lot of faith so you can actually buy those great people late in the game, piety provides faith.
And you could decide that if that's the only reason you were going in piety, once you have it, you could take rationalism later.
That is true.
Like, oh, gee, we were just talking about social policies. Hey, guess what? More social policies. Or more like alternatives to social policies. So Langdon, over on the TK forums, is talking about what the social policy should really be. He likes it. He thinks it's a great improvement in Civ, replacing the government forms. He's like, however, the social policies in the game are just benefits of accumulated culture points. They're nice buffs, but really... Oh, wait. What does this mean? They're nice buffs, but really helpful. Do you mean not health? I don't know.
Yeah, I think he's missing an important word.
Yeah.
Yeah.
His argument is having identity crisis.
His argument is piety, what? But he wants them to be different. He has a few examples where they would have a benefit and a cost. Because the current ones, it's just a benefit. You have no cost. You can be in whatever form of government. It doesn't cost you anything. Like where is in other Civ games, you had at least some restrictions. Yeah, like the fun thing in Civ 1 and Civ 2, where if you were in Democracy or Republic, you couldn't declare war without the Senate.
It would force you into peace, too. When I look at these bonuses that a lot of these proposed social policies are giving, it looks almost like a building. Like you get a small amount of something and you have a gold cost.
Government building, I guess.
Yeah, and some of them are more expensive than it'd be worth, like organized religion. Plus one faith from shrines and temples, and you'd cost one gold per shrine and temple.
Ow.
Straight one faith to one gold cost? Ew. I wouldn't want to do anything to do with that. I don't know. Basically, yeah, it looks like he wants to turn social policies into more select and go.
He wants them to have a downside as well as an upside, basically.
Except that all those downsides are money.
Yeah, it's money, money.
Yeah, and the current downside to the social policy tree that we have overall is choosing one social policy over another.
Yeah.
You know, you're choosing the benefit of one at the expense of not getting the other. They seem to be like Civ 4 civics, only negative. It's kind of like telling someone, this is what you can do, and this is what you can't do. And he wants to phrase it as, this is what you can't do. And he also tries to draw in a realism argument as well, which he kind of backs away from because people kind of pounced on that.
I wonder why.
That first sentence about a great improvement for Civ 5, replacing government forms in previous Civs. Well, I think he is forgetting the civics from Civ 4, actually. Which this is what, again, it reminds me of only worse versions of civics.
we could very easily rewrite the social policies to fit this model. You know, we could say that, you know, if you go down the tradition tree, then you produce settlers half as fast, or, you know, 33% slower rather than getting a 50% settler buff down going down the liberty line, right? I don't necessarily know that that would add anything. I mean, it would make things look a little different. It might make things feel a little different, but it wouldn't actually change the gameplay in any meaningful way. The way it's set up right now, the idea is simply that the opportunity cost of not taking the liberty policy is effectively the cost of taking the tradition policy. And whether we juggle that around, if you actually sit down and you run the math on this sort of thing, taking this approach doesn't alter anything in terms of how the game plays or what you would choose to do on any given turn.
Yeah. Well, if you, I guess, switch to his suggested change, most of what he's doing is policies that can be turned on and off, except that when you turn them on, the only cost is gold, but you can get gold anywhere in the game. Whereas in Civ 5, your cost is all in culture, and you have to produce culture. The next social policy is going to cost you a lot in comparison, and if you expand, it'll cost you a lot. So I think the cost part is a little weird that he's focusing on gold.
Why don't some of these have a cost in something else? Like it costs you faith for something or costs you culture for something.
Yeah, like a religious policy that with the religion spread. So what I was talking about, if you want better, you know, organized religion within your own empire, say plus 33% faith spread within my empire, except that it costs me an extra amount of faith per city.
If you want something along those lines, I think you go back and look all the way back to the Alpha Centauri model where you had, like, I don't know, something like 10 different attributes, and basically, yes, you know, enabling one of those social engineering values would give you buffs to some of them and a debuff to a different one.
Yeah.
Yeah, like take environmentalism and all your production goes down, even though your green rating with the planet went up.
That's the point of social policies, kind of. Socially experimenting.
Yeah, and he says social policies in the game are just benefits of accumulated culture points. They are nice buffs, but really aren't helpful in the overall gaming.
I don't know.
Wait a minute. Like, maybe, okay, why don't I accept that they are, quote-unquote, just benefits of accumulated culture points, but not really helpful in the overall gaming? Pardon?
Like half the world. No, 90% of all strategies ever written for this game have probably half of it based around doing something with social policies. Like, go liberty to rationalism with a little bit of freedom. Go tradition to rationalism with a little bit of order, you know. I think social policies are a pretty good chunk of the game when it comes to strategy.
I like how, in the very last post, at least as of this recording, Megan Dolphin says, so the only problem with social policies is their name.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess you can argue that. Are these really social policies, or can you think of some other system that would get social policies as a better name?
Culture policies.
Yeah.
That's of accumulated culture points. I'm glad I could solve this thread.
Don't worry. The next expansion will change the name of social policies.
And then there was in the last part of his main post where he was talking about having ideology points if you were using different things, like having social warfare give you socialism, which I guess this would be part of diplomacy in the end game. You had a culture that had more democracy points instead of communism points. They'd hate each other.
That actually is not a horrible thing, based around if you're going to start incorporating governments in Civ 5. Because obviously you're not going to come back and do governments the same way as in Civ 4, where it's, you know, the choices and you can keep flipping back and forth. So I could see a potential system where, you know, what social policies you've chosen or opened or whatever count towards a government style that you could choose to be part of. Say if you go tradition, you have more options towards monarchy or feudalistic or, you know, the very various options within that versus if you went liberty. And especially obvious, the most obvious is order, freedom, or autocracy choices, which currently have a diplomatic penalty, depending on how you chose that, or a bonus, depending.
Yes.
If everybody goes order, you get lots of friends. If whoever went autocracy is now disliked by most people. So there is that, but you can extend that sort of concept to stuff like, you know, commercial empires versus the truly city-state big brother sort of thing. A lot more work to balance it out so it's not just a knock-on effect.
The heroes now, behemoth, those and peasants now.
comments on episode 153. We have a few here. First by Apocalypse105, saying Swordsmen and Gods and Kings. And they're useful. Don't forget you can upgrade them to long swords. Also, long swords, upgrade the musket. Okay, so he's talking about the upgrade path. I know Majin mentioned that in the show as well, that swords have a pretty viable upgrade path you can use for them. And Babri argues that as a unit itself, swordsman's underwhelming, too expensive to research. I don't know about that. And can't fight well against walled cities, which is pretty true.
Not true.
And I disagree about them being inferior to spears. Well, I guess it depends who you're fighting too.
Oh, they require iron.
They don't cost iron. Yeah, they require iron and therefore are inferior to spears. I don't know. Swords do pretty well against spears in a straight-up fight. So for that time frame, they're pretty good. And Apocalypse answers back. They're basically just going back and forth on swords there, and you cannot afford swords. Then we have a long post by, is it Nokmer or Nokamer? Or do any of you guys know? I think it's probably one of those two, but we'll go with Nokamer. And this one's one of those TLDRs. I read it, but I'm not going to read it on the show because that would probably take up a good 4 minutes of your time if I read the entire thing out loud. So I actually wrote a few things down just as points to highlight. First of all, I do agree, and I know we touched on it in the show a little bit, that conquest and domination should probably be distinctive victory conditions. Again, there's really no reason Civ 5 can't do it. It would not be that hard to implement, most likely. So, yeah, I don't see any downside to that. You get conquest if you take all their capitals. You get domination if you control that much percentage of the world's land. Different victory conditions, different challenges to getting them. Domination would probably be the harder one on a consistent basis. But, you know, who cares? You know, there's always going to be harder and easier victory conditions. The capital is a political force. Yeah, that's basically what the second paragraph sums up to, is an interesting concept. He's basically suggesting that capitals are still important. He rescinded his assertion that they should be raisable entities in terms of, you know, burning them down. But he feels like, you know, the AI should try to bargain to get it back and stopping war agreements, and should be a lot more amenable to getting host if it's already lost its capital. I think it would be a hard thing to balance mechanically. And then when you go to multiplayer, that mechanic would be out the window because human players probably wouldn't care.
You're like, I got your capital.
Yeah, sounds about right.
Yeah, well, yeah, you control them, but they're not going to treat the loss of their capital much differently from the loss of any other crucial city, aside from the fact that they're probably almost dead if you took their capital. But that's another matter for the most part. Diplomacy needs some things added to it. He suggests to bring back secret pacts, which I don't know. What benefit do they have? Is my real question here. That's why they were removed in the first place.
Well, they got switched out for a few other things that weren't really worked. But the one thing in that paragraph that I think he's pointing towards for that secret pact is being able to get more than just one civ to attack on the same turn. So if you manage to, you know, find a couple AIs that are willing to all DAO the same other player or AI, depending on what you're doing, being able to do that in one shot rather than having to go to each individual one going, will you DAO in 10 turns? Okay. Now I have a new agreement with that other civ that I have to question. Will you DAO in 10 turns? Rather than just all at one.
I have doubts about its viability in terms of the AI, because this is something you could easily set up in multiplayer, no doubt about that. You don't even need any special game mechanics to do it. But with the AI, even when the AI tag teams you currently, it's silliness. You know, they don't actually attack with the units in coordination. These alliances where someone declares war from across the world. I've had civs declare war on me for committing some atrocities, and then I don't see a unit for 10 plus turns. Sometimes I didn't even commit atrocities. They just declared war on me, and I don't see a unit attack me for forever. And when they do, it's like almost nothing. So yeah, they're quote unquote at war with you, but it's...
You should upgrade to Gods and Kings.
Yeah, maybe I should. And then the last paragraph, man, this is something that irks me to no end. And, you know, this is something I've been back and forth with in Hall of Fame discussions and everything else. I don't like the idea of using offensive citadels because the AI does not use them. It's like, come on now, really? So are you not going to sell luxury resources to farm research agreements? Are you not going to use your resources properly? Are you going to deliberately build stupid things? I mean, where do you draw the line here? They put this mechanic in the game for a reason. And part of the reason the AI gets bonuses is because it doesn't use the resources in the game effectively. If it did, it wouldn't need the bonuses. I mean, this is ridiculous. You just pick anything you happen not to like for whatever reason and say, oh, it's not good because the AI doesn't use it. No.
No, in this particular cases, AIs do actually use citadels properly even.
Do they?
Yeah, they will culture bomb you with their citadels.
As an explicit military attack that makes sense on a consistent basis?
Sometimes.
Do they do that?
I've seen an
so
AI.
Not consistently, but sometimes.
Well, no, I've seen an AI steal territory to grab a luxury. That's a citadel. Okay. I've seen in a war an AI drop multiple citadels in a row to get closer to a city or a capital. Okay. Actually, in that okay. case.
Well, then that makes this argument even less valid. The AI does do it, sort of. So, I mean, what the heck?
Not very well, but they still do it.
Well, the AI doesn't play very well. I mean, it's like an argument against playing single player at all, which is silly because I think more people still play single player than multiplayer by a decent margin. So you can make up whatever pretend rules you want when you're playing a game in single player, or you can cheat as much as you want too, sure. But yeah, it just seems odd to make this argumentative case that you should use only X or Y in the general sense because of AI limitations.
The intention of reading this was not to roast or criticize for criticize's sake. It's just that I saw some arguments in there that we don't usually hear on this show. So to present them and to respond to them, especially given that these comments came in response to our previous episode where we were talking about these things.
Yeah, this is not a
and
way
like
to...
The idea, Alliance's idea is a very good one. It's just that the AI, I don't think, could handle it properly. But you know, it would add flavor to the game if the AI could do tandem attacks like that as part of an alliance and sometimes do them with you against other AIs as well. You know, that would be a good thing for the game. I agree. You know, there are a lot of good points throughout this entire thread, but including from Nokemert or Nokmert. Nokmert. Yes.
Yeah, it's just the last one that he doesn't like.
Yeah, that last one I do take exception to. I don't like that comment at all.
I take exception to the second last post. I don't know why.
Well, that's just standard. And of course, as of this recording, we are referring specifically to post number 6 because should you be listening? Second last post might change.
But, yeah, in a week, it's like,
why do you hate me?
Please, somebody else post. It'll be the different second last post.
Hello, this is Kana Salvin.
Hello, how are you?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you guys?
Not too bad. You have a question, comment?
Well, I do have a comment to say that I was listening to Polycast pretty much exclusively for the last 4 or 5 months because I'm autistic and I enjoy listening to the same thing over and over again, so I've heard every episode several times now.
So did you come across the show 4 or 5 months ago then?
I've been listening off and on since a couple of years ago, but I haven't had a lot of time up until then.
So do you enjoy it?
Oh, yes, I love it.
It's always encouraging.
I would say you're doing pretty good the way you are.
Do you play Civilization 4 and or 5?
I play both. I play 5 more than 4, though. I'm only a Warlord level player, so I'm not that good, but I try.
Well, you're having fun, right? I mean, that's...
Oh, yeah, I love it.
All that matters.
Yeah.
Not everyone wants to train to become a good player. That's sometimes not too fun of a process for...
Training? Who trains? You have to train to be good?
I train. Yeah, I have to train to be good, man. I do push-ups. I run laps.
Do you have any comments or questions on topics today? Is there something in there that you want to throw some words at?
Well, sometimes I wonder why they... bother changing certain things that don't seem like they need changing, but I don't think there's any answer that can be given to that because everybody wants that.
For anything specific?
Well, not really. Everything has changed so much in the last year that I'm just trying to catch up.
Oh, you mean like with all the patching and everything else where the game's constantly getting readjusted and readjusted?
Yeah, that can be pretty rough. And that's one of those things when you release a title a bit early and then patch it until it's actually got a balanced title, is that there is that adjustment period. The mechanics have changed so drastically since vanilla release. The things you could do in vanilla release were just crazy.
I remember some of those things.
Do you have the Gods and Kings expansion?
Yes, I do.
Had you purchased any of the DLC before then?
I have all the DLC, yes.
Oh, wow.
We talked a few episodes ago just about rating Gods and Kings. You mean you could give a number, but overall, would you say that you're happy with the changes?
Oh, I give it a 9. I really love the changes. It actually makes it fun to play.
See, there you go.
Comparatively.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I actually really like Civ 5. If it ran better, I would play it quite a bit. You do have better social policy balance now. You actually have to think about what you're doing from a start to end game approach. And, you know, the tactics are much better than you've had in previous iterations. And yes, Civ 4 has some excellent tactics as well, but there's just a lot that Civ 5 has going for it.
Wait. Did Phil just say something nice about Civ 5 in comparison to Civ 4?
He has said this before.
Until they do something about how the engine works, it's just going to slow down my willingness to play it. I still play it now and then, but
they are working on it. It's just maybe not super fast yet. But it is still based on the Civ 4 engine, and they can't quite delete the engine.
I thought they made a new engine for Civ 5.
There's definitely code in there that's suspiciously the same.
Yeah.
Back when it was first coming out and you were interviewing people about it, there were statements that were saying that the Civ 5 engine started as Civilization Revolution PS3 engine, but that it still had all the original functionality of the Civ 4 engine. I don't remember who said that specifically, but that's what I heard on you guys' show, actually.
A couple final questions to you, Candace Albinus, and then an opportunity for a final comment if you want. How did you find Polycast?
DFC.
And now, how do you listen to the show? Do you download the episodes off of the website? Do you load them on through iTunes? Or
I have them all downloaded on my hard drive and on my MP3 player, and I listen to them when I'm driving.
I hope you'd be willing to call in again. And also, thank you for listening to the show live as well. We know that depending upon the time zone and, you know, what you've got going on, we do very much appreciate it.
You're very welcome. I enjoy it.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 441-212-88-7659. That's 441-212-88-POLY.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast, Revcast, and Turncast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
Did you just actually bring up singing, Mackie? Did I hear that properly?
No, he brought up singing.
I think Mackie wants us to sing.
No, I do not.
Strategic.
Stop it.
That's right. None of that.
Oh, Mackie's going to want you back on the show so often.
Well, if he's listened to previous episodes, Dan, he probably knows what that involves and how it sounds.
It sounds like
This has been episode 154 of the Polycast with you.
I think you said me right. We were suddenly in a wind tunnel.
Makalua?
I'm not in a wind tunnel.
The B&T?
I have a wind tunnel anytime you need one.
Mad Jim?
Insert not a wind tunnel comment here.
And I am Bart Alvito, and I'm also not in a wind tunnel.
Yeah, that was a wind tunnel that was my cat jumping up and trying to eat my mic.
Oh, was it? Oh, I was going to blame Phil.
In any event, we appreciate you all tuning in. Thank you very much for listening.
I'm past the point of saying it's impossible for me to make such mistakes because, you know, I'm getting old or something, even though, never mind. But aren't we all? Yeah, I actually happen to be one of the younger co-hosts on the show, so I'm kind of trolling everyone else with that comment. That's for fun. However, birthday's coming up soon, so you know we're going to be a year older. Moments
all together days. At the same time.
Yeah, all of us. All of us.
Record date August 11th, 2012. Civilization 4 and 5 sound clips, copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.